Hello, welcome to Poet Runner. I'm Rafael Alvarado, and my co-host Richard Modiano is here too. And today we'll be discussing.
I'm David Lehman.
There we go. Happy. And we'll be discussing David's book, The Mysterious Romances of Murder, a book about noir. Richard, take it away.
Well, I thought the book was incredibly comprehensive.
Oh, thank you very much. I had a wonderful time writing it. It was a silver lining in the pandemic since I had to be sort of shut in the whole time, and I got to do this writing about a subject that I love.
Yeah, well, what I mean, you obviously did a tremendous amount of research for this because it's literally no stone unturned, and the whole history, the background, the cultural resonances of noir are all touched upon in this. And the other thing that I really like about it is you go into film, you go into cinema with an intelligence. You really looked at the films, and it's not more than just looking at the surface of the plot, but there's also the style of the filmmaker and how this all fits in with in the larger genre of the mystery. So what was your – I mean, tell me about the overall conception that you had about this, I mean, when you decided to undertake this project.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for your compliments. Greatly appreciated. The writer is always thrilled to have an appreciative reader, and I was just reading something by Samuel Beckett, who wrote in 1936 that he was thinking of taking up flying. Because, and I quote, "I do not feel like spending the rest of my life writing books that no one will read." And that's the great Beckett. In my case, I've always loved both noir movies and detective novels and mysteries of all kinds. And it's a particular joy when something that you regard as potentially work that will enrich the world in some way, is also a great deal of fun for you as the writer. And so I got to see the movies, and I would watch them 3 or 4 times, even if I'd already seen them. I would see The Asphalt Jungle or The Killing or Double Indemnity over and over, to capture things that you might have missed the first or second time around. And I felt that I could make a particular contribution to the study of noir as a style and as a genre and as a period. The chapter called Paradise of the Damned, I think, is one of those that I'm very proud of. And also the chapters on the various props that are in these movies, like cigarettes, cocktails, popular songs. And there could have been chapters on guns, on fedoras,
yeah,
on the telephone. How the telephone functions in these movies.
Well, this is one of the sharpest paragraphs, and it was from the chapter Paradise of the Damned that you just mentioned. Both Samuel Fuller's pickup on South Street, 1953, and Robert Bresson's pickpocket, 1959, are about guys who ride the subway to lift the wallets of unsuspecting riders. But in the former, an American movie, the guy does it for money. Whereas in the French film, it is to test out a theory. There, in a nutshell, are two rival national conceptions of what noir is about. And to me, this was sort of characteristic of the whole book, making these really great connections. And I don't know if you know this, but According to Bresson in an interview, his actual inspiration for Pickpocket was Fuller's pickup on South Street.
No kidding. I didn't know that, although
yeah.
I did connect the two in the most obvious ways. I mean, sort of suspected that the Bresson had seen Samuel Fuller's movies, since Fuller's movies are prized by the French cineasts. But I think there's a very big difference in the sense that the American movie really begins with a motif having to do with crime as a means of acquiring money. And it is only by chance that the theft in the subway turns into a larger espionage, Cold War story, where the French movie is really has its roots not in life of crime or thievery, but in a kind of sense of existential anguish.
Yeah, exactly. And I did not know, I mean, I'd seen both films several times over the decades. And it was not until recently that I believe I was reading, it was the Criterion Channel's blog entry, and they were the ones that was where I first learned just a few months ago that his inspiration was a pickup on South Street. So, you know, I figured that you probably did not know that and just made the connection by virtue of your insight. And that's one of the great things that I like about this book. I mean, it's like, if you are into the crime fiction genre, the detective genre, if you are interested in noir, if you are interested in the cultural ramifications of all of these genres, this is the book to read. And let me ask you again, just exactly how much time did it take you to do all of the research for this book? Because it's pretty impressive along those lines.
Well, that's a difficult question to answer because from one point of view, it took about 50 years. From another point of view, it took a year and a half or 2 years. What I mean is that it's about 50 or so years ago, I got very heavily involved in reading Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. I was a graduate student in England at Cambridge University, and I decided that my thesis would be on these two writers, which was at the time a radical decision in Oxford or Cambridge. It would be a little less radical now. And ever since, I was attracted and, you know, and so I've been reading for all those decades. But I didn't undertake the book and the specific research toward it until I would say it was the fall of, it was just before the pandemic. It would have been around 2019 that I started taking notes, rereading books that I hadn't read before, watching the movies, some of which I hadn't seen before, and doing it in a very thorough way. I feel that I'm very sort of eclectic and ecumenical in the sense that I'm not just interested in murder mysteries, or I'm not just interested in detective movies, or I'm interested in the whole gamut, the whole range. And there, you know, I mean, Agatha Christie is one kind of writer, and Raymond Chandler is another. I'm interested in all the permutations.
And I think that comes over very clearly. And this is, by the way, I want to alert our listeners, this is not a dry academic book. This book is it's fun to read, and it's totally absorbing. And to give you an idea of how interesting it is, there is a chapter called Five Noir Poems, because David is also a poet. And I wondered if you could read one of those poems. Do you have the book with you?
Certainly.
Okay, good. Well,
I
wonder
have
if
the
you
book.
Could...
And...
Good, because I want you... treat our listeners to one of those poems, if you will. Pick one of your own choosing.
Well, Ryan, I'd be happy to. Do you have a suggestion? Did you want
let's try, you know, Laura is one of the most famous noirs, and most of our listeners would probably be familiar with it. So let's hear that one.
Good. I think that's a very good choice. Of course, it's a wonderful movie, and it's directed by Otto Preminger with Dana Andrews and Gene Tierney and Clifton Webb. It has marvelous music by David Raxon that was written before there were lyrics. The lyrics were added later by Johnny Mercer. And I wrote a poem called Laura in the form of a pantoum. In a pantoum, every line appears twice. And I felt that that was right for this movie and many others, where things happen and happen again, and so a rare form that involves repetition would seem very suitable to certain murder mysteries like Laura. Here it is, Laura. Then the doorbell rang. Time for one more cigarette. It wasn't Laura's body on the kitchen floor. He is not in love with a corpse. Time for one more cigarette. The venomous drama critic insinuates he is in love with a corpse. It's a typical male-female mix-up. The venomous drama critic knows he is sane. It's a typical male-female mix-up. He thinks she is dead, and she thinks he is rude. Is he sane? Each wonders what the other is doing in her living room. He thinks she is a ghost, and she thinks he is rude, when the picture on the wall becomes a flesh and blood woman. Each wonders what the other is doing in her living room. It hasn't stopped raining. The picture on the wall becomes a flesh and blood woman, Jean Tierney, in Laura. It hasn't stopped raining. Dames are always pulling a switch on you, Dana Andrews says in Laura. There was something he was forgetting. Dames are always pulling a switch on you. It wasn't Laura's body on the kitchen floor. There was something he was forgetting. Then the doorbell rang.
Yeah, that's great. That's really good, David. I love that one. And
well,
by the way, there was a television remake of Laura. With the teleplay was written by, of all people, Truman Capote, and Lee Radswell played Laura, and George Sanders played Waldo. Farley Granger played the Vincent Price part in the original. And Steve Forrest, who was Dana Andrews' brother, played the detective.
Well, the casting is really wonderful because George Sanders was himself the drama critic in All About Eve.
Right.
And when you think of, you know, theater critics who are instrumental and manipulative behind the scenes and wield a lot of power, you think of Clifton Webb as Waldo Lydecker and George Sanders as Addison DeWitt. So that's a perfect casting. And So that sounds pretty interesting. Usually, I think remakes are a bad idea, like the Big Sleep. I love Robert Mitchum, but I just don't see why they would do that.
It was pretty.
On the other hand,
very inferior.
Yes, I agree. Well, I think Murder My Sweet with Dick Powell was magnificent, and but I do like Farewell My Lovely with Robert Mitchum, so that's an exception, I guess.
Yeah, that one was good. That one was good, yeah.
Well, Mitchum is a real noir character. He's perfect in A Raincoat, and of course, Out of the Past, he's Mr. Noir. And Dana Andrews is another, you know, a wonderful noir actor who, you know, seems haunted. And it's a film called Where the Sidewalk Ends.
That's a great one for him. Yeah, that's sort of like the bad cop subgenre of noir that includes ones like I Wake Up Screaming. There was the other one, the other Otto Preminger one with him where he's in the small town. I forget the name of it, but he's not the bad cop. It's the other guy's the bad cop. And, of course, Touch of Evil, another classic bad cop one.
Well, even when the cop is motivated by, you know, the instincts that we would like to have in a cop, like Gene Hackman in The French Connection, he shoots another cop at the end.
Yeah,
it's by mistake.
Yeah.
But one scene that you find is that the criminal and the detective are related. There's a sense of a twin or double. And this goes back to Edgar Allan Poe, where the Dupin, the detective, has to try to get into the mind of his opponent, whose last name also begins with D. And in fact, Poirot in Christie always says, "Oh, I'll discover the crime when I understand the mind of the person who did it." And maybe this isn't limited only to detective and culprit, because psychoanalysts and psychiatrists are always turning one another in as insane. As if the line between the patient and the doctor is also can be blurred.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I also like the chapters on individual auteurs, so to speak, both writers and filmmakers. And I was really glad that you paid attention to Ida Lupino, who, of course, is an actress and was also a director. And two of her well-known ones, The Bigamist and The Hitchhiker, were really outstanding draws, I thought.
Oh, I agree entirely. I think she's a wonderful actress. She enhances every movie she's in, whether it's While the City Sleeps or High Sierra. But as a director, she has a particularly interesting angle. The Hitchhiker, I'm not sure there's a woman in the film, and yet the film, in a way, with William Tallman as the villain. Tallman, who becomes Hamilton Berger in the Perry Mason TV series, never wins a case. He is a thug with an eye that doesn't quite work, and he's a sadist. And he decides that of the two men who pick him up in the car when he's hitchhiking, that he feels that Edmund O'Brien is the more vulnerable than Frank Lovejoy, and he sets them apart. And at one point in that film, he has Frank Lovejoy shooting a can held by Edmund O'Brien. And I advanced the notion that in a way that since there's no reason for the killer to act this way toward these people, he's merely trying to escape. He's a wanted man. Why is he doing these things? And the nearest thing I could think of was that it was like a rape. That's the movie was weirdly, although it's about men, was allegorically like a rape. The other movie you mentioned, The Bigamist, is a very, very interesting because it treats the characters not as demons and villains, but as quite sympathetic all the way around. That's very unusual. And then, of course, the backstory to know that there were these interlocking relationships among the actors and producers that mimicked the sort of bride swapping, if you want to call it, that's in the movie.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is unusual to see a woman director. It's basically a woman's take on these things that we, especially during that period, we didn't get to see that very often. Even if the screenwriter was a woman, the director was usually a man. And the fact that she was able to direct these pictures and give us this particular take on things was unique. And that's why I was very glad to see that you highlighted Ida Lupino in the book.
Well, I could write a lot more about her because she also directed. She also directed other movies of great interest.
Yeah.
And one thing that seems very interesting to me is that in The Bigamist and I believe in The Hitchhiker, no one is killed, and that's very unusual in a noir. In a noir, there's almost always a violent death, or more than one. And she conveys the terror in one case and the real darkness in the other without the ultimate crime. So that seems very interesting to me. If you think of Out of the Past, think of how many dead bodies there are. Or in Double Indemnity, the Fred McMurray and Barbara Sandwick are not going to be alive at the end of that movie. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, well, also, I mean, I think of the chapter in Red Harvest, I think it's called The 19th Murder or something like that. Or if not the 19th murder, the 20th murder.
And, you know, Chandler had the idea that if you were at a loss for what to do to advance the plot, you're going to have a man ring the doorbell, enter with a gun, and shoot. Which actually happens in The Big Sleep.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And the other chapter that I really enjoyed was Hitchcock's America, because Hitchcock has been written about over and over again, but your take is a fresh take on Hitchcock, and all of the things that you pick up on in his movies are really fascinating. I mean, they tend to be sort of overlooked or effaced in most cases, but I like the way you single them out. I like what you said about Saboteur and honing in on the name of the protagonist, Barry Kane, the fact that the name Kane is a strike against him, as you put it, I thought that was really good. I thought that was very insightful.
Well, thank you again. I'm so pleased to have so attentive and observant a reader. There is something about the name Kane that, you know, the marshal in High Noon is named Will Kane.
Yeah, right.
And the Kane Mutiny and Citizen Kane. And there are, I think there are other examples as well. One of the interesting things to me, this is very far afield, but you know Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway, his top two younger lieutenants are named Jane and Abel.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Yes, I think the one who's going to succeed him is, I think, named Greg Abel. And the other one, I forgot his first name, but his last name is Jane, J-A-I-N. So I thought that was curious. But, you know, names are always interestingly chosen, or maybe not always, but often.
Yeah, that's true.
The Hitchcock chapter was a great deal of fun to write because he's an Englishman and he has a vision of America. And two of his movies are set in Santa Rosa, where, in fact, he lived. Shadow of a Doubt is one, and The Birds
yeah.
is the other. Two very, very different films with very different outcomes. So to me, what is his idea of America? And in some sense, he's a great patriot with the speech at the end of Foreign Correspondent, America to get into the war. Or in Saboteur, the Statue of Liberty and the lines recited at the statue from Emma Lazarus's great poem, or even Mount Rushmore. There's a certain kind of love affair with America. I think it's really there in Shadow of a Doubt, where small town America is celebrated in a sense like It's a Wonderful Life. But there's also the darkness, the psycho,
yeah, exactly.
the vertigo, and the birds.
Well, there's even darkness, since you mentioned It's a Wonderful Life in connection with Shadow of a Doubt. Both films show the dark side of small-town life.
Absolutely. You know, one thing that happened that in writing this book is that I felt that popular songs contributed a great deal to the
movies. Oh, yeah,
that's
another great chapter. That's another really wonderful chapter, yeah.
And that, you know, the music, even if you don't know the song or the lyrics, you know, they're just delightful. But if you do know the lyrics, you can see that the song might be in counterpoint to the action. Well, I got to a point where I thought, well, one of the greatest uses of popular song in movies of the 40s was the song Among My Souvenirs in The Best mm-hmm. Years of Our Lives. Well, Best Years of Our Lives, has these three veterans who come home, and they have a tough time of it, but by the end of the movie, one man marries, another one is with his sweetheart, and you know all is going to end well. But I thought, well, you've got the makings of a noir here. If this were a noir, the Dana Andrews character who can't get a job, he's going to turn crooked. The guy with no hands is a perfect character to be enlisted in the gang. And so I wrote about it that way, and then I found out only after I'd written this that the original script for The Best Years of Our Lives was in fact like I just said, a kind of noir plot. And it was also written in blank verse, which is really weird.
That's interesting. Well, there are two. This brings me to two things. Your Shadow, Best Years of Our Lives, there is a sort of another subgenre, and this is the PTSD veteran who is traumatized by the recent war and has lost memory or has developed a split personality. I'm thinking of, there was one that I saw for the first time recently. It was Joseph L. Mankiewicz's third picture, and I think it was something called Somewhere in the Night, where John Hodiak plays a returned veteran who's lost his memory. And as he reconstructs who he was in his life before going into the service, he comes to see that, in fact, he was this brutal gangster. And erasing his memory has changed his personality.
Well, that's wonderful. I'd love to see that movie. and, of course, that's a great trope, the returning veteran who has been, you know, changed and usually not for the better by the horrors that he has experienced. And a second great trope is the loss of memory and the kind of temporary or permanent amnesia. These are just wonderful fictional, what ifs. To combine them is very, very clever and very, very good.
Well, I think we're just about out of time, David. I've been talking to David Lehman. His book is The Mysterious Romance of Murder, Crime, Detection, and the Spirit of Noir. It is certainly one of the most entertaining and comprehensive books that I've read on the subject, because he leaves no stone unturned. For if you are a fan of the genre in all its media, movies, music, literature, this is the book to read, and it is published by Cornell University Press. I do encourage you to buy it directly from the publisher or your independent bookstore, and as a last resort, go to Amazon, but do support our authors by buying their books, and I can't recommend this more highly. So, David, thank you for your time, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Richard, it's been a great pleasure on my part, and I have to compliment you because you are obviously quite a incisive and thoughtful viewer of these movies that we've been talking about and the books we've been talking about. So I could talk to you for hours.
Hell, same here.
Send me a link, if you would, to this podcast, because I'd like to share it.
Sure. Raphael will take care of that.
Yep.
Now, this has been a wonderful conversation, and I'll look for that John Hodiak Mankiewicz movie that you mentioned.
Yeah, I think it's Somewhere in the Night. I'm sure that's it now.
Somewhere in the Night. Well, that's as noir a title as one could possibly want.
It sure is.
Thank you so much, Richard.
All right. Have a good one.
Same to you, buddy.
And now the running part of Poet Runner, we have Michael Abram coming on the air. Hello, Michael.
Hello, how are you?
Hello. Pretty good.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Yes, I can hear you just fine.
Because I feel really bad and guilty, and I want to spread the guilt today. Did you run today?
No, today's my off day.
I don't feel so bad because I had an off day, and I don't like taking off days, and I was giving myself crap all day for not running today.
Yeah, I'm pretty sore from yesterday, so I need this day to recover.
So how many miles do you run a day? I mean, when you train?
Well, it depends on the day, but typically it's anywhere from 5 to 15.
That's a good number. And someone recently told me to switch it up to do 10-5, 10-5, so I've been doing 10-5 for the last 2 to 3 weeks.
How's that working out?
Pretty good, because I haven't been doing speed runs for a while, and my 5 miles were coming up to like hour and 20 minutes, hour and 10 minutes, and then when I started doing the speed runs, I got the five miles done in like my best time so far has been 37 minutes.
Oh, that's not bad.
So,
I suppose.
Well, no, I felt good about it because I didn't think I was gonna, because I hadn't tried or made an effort for a while. Making the effort, you know, I've been doing a speed run every other day now, so even when I hit 40 minutes, I don't feel so bad because, you know, it's under an hour, you know, so it's kind of like,
yeah, for sure.
Doing okay. Why did you start running?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I just, one day I just started running. I felt like I needed to get going on something. And I just started out of the blue and then I immediately quit 'cause it hurt too bad. and then I picked it up again a few months later and I've stuck with it. And it's been, you know, a lot of things I've discovered about running is just more than, you know, just running.
Oh no, I definitely learned that the body can do a lot. Cause I just did a 31-mile run and I realized you can run for 8 hours and 23 minutes and still keep going and not feel tired afterwards.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good distance.
Yeah. The thing is, I didn't know till the girl I'm hanging out with told me it was one of the toughest courses in LA. It's the Bulldog Run, the Bulldog Ultra, and I didn't know because of the elevation, and then I learned about the elevation very quickly.
I can imagine. So that's what are those, like 100-mile races or 50 miles?
No, just 31. It's 50K. So
oh, 31. Okay.
But
yeah, I haven't gotten that far yet. I'm still training for a marathon, so I haven't gotten that many miles yet.
But you'll get there. I mean, I've been running off and on since I was 15, but I knew you just got serious about 3 years ago. Well,
yeah.
I think all
it's
go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, it's definitely, you know, I just found that there's way more to running than just hitting the pavement. You know, there's a lot of strategy involved, a lot of mental toughness you have to develop. And, you know, it's been a really good sport.
This woman I interviewed, Sabrina, she just did 100 miles, and she did it in 28 hours and 26 minutes.
Oh, man, that's impressive.
That's brutal to me. It's kind of like, ow, you know, it's kind of like.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing is, you know, like you're like where I was, like, you know, at the beginning. I mean, right now, to me, 50 and 100 miles seems a lot, but right now, probably for you, a marathon, you're not there yet, but once you get there, you realize once you hit a marathon and you do them a couple of times, it's like, this is getting kind of easy. I need more miles.
Yeah, you know, I've already thought about doing an ultra, but I got to do one thing at a time. And I think I've done the half marathons, and now I'm really focusing on getting this marathon accomplished. And then we'll see. Hopefully I can keep going, and I'd really like to do an ultra. But, you know, I've got to get these legs conditioned. It's going to take a little while, I think.
Yeah, definitely. The legs are important, and you know how you take care of. I learned that when I first started running 3 years ago, and I gave myself shin splints right away. It's like that was bad. I ran too much.
Yeah, when I did the same. I did the same thing. My first month of running, I pulled a calf muscle, and I had to learn to slow down and let this body adapt. You know, without going too hard in the beginning.
With the miles, it's a different set of problems that come up. I mean, when I did the 31 miles, my knees locked out on the 19th mile when I was doing the second loop going uphill, and I couldn't move for like 10 minutes because my knees were locked out and they were in pain. But eventually, I worked through it and kept the running. But it's like, I think the amount of miles brings different things that can happen when you're running, you know.
Yeah, and
you
that's a good point. I think that's a good point because there's a fine line between continually going and then getting an injury to where you can't go anymore.
Yep. So what marathon are you training for?
I'm training for the Seattle Marathon right now. It's in November.
Cool. So this is your first one.
Yeah, my first marathon, and then I've been racing a lot this year just to, you know, to keep it kind of spicy, keep the running interesting, and met some really nice people during these races. And and then, you know, just training when I'm not racing, just run a couple 5 days a week mostly.
So what's the most miles you've ran? I mean, what's your most miles?
My limit right now is 17.
Yeah. No, that's a good number. I mean, once you get hit to 20s and 22s and 23s, 26 is easy.
Well, I heard after 20. Yeah, I heard after 20, that's like the halfway mark of the marathon, even, you know, because that last six is really tough.
Yeah, I think because I've done about 10, 11 marathons now. Every time I start, it's always like, I mean, I don't know why, but every time I start, it's like, why am I here? but that's just me, because every time every race I start is like, why am I here? And you know, once you get going 4 or 5 miles in, then you realize how much you enjoy it.
I think that's with me every time I run. Every day that I run, I'm thinking, why am I doing this? But after the first couple of miles, then you realize, you know, all the things kick in and it starts to feel good, and then you want to do it again when you're done.
Well, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, that's definitely true. You know, and, but yeah, I mean, yeah, so, how often do you stall? Because I stall almost every day.
What do you mean by stall?
Well, you do things to avoid it, like, you know, re-up your playlist, do a little more stuff in the gym before you start your run. You know, it's kind of like, you know, 15, 20 minutes that you could have already been running.
Well, I don't really stall anymore. I know I have to run that day, and I sort of look forward to it until the time comes to run, and then it's like, you know, your mental starts to happen, and then after I run the first mile or two, then it's already, you know, you're back in the game of it. So I don't really stall out too much. I think right before the run, you know, your body's kind of not there yet, and but once you get a couple of miles in, then it starts to feel really good. And I think that's how I've been taking it so far. Just trying to follow that schedule and stay in focus. I mean, sometimes you miss a day, you feel kind of guilty, try to make it up.
No, it's definitely, I mean, because I try not to weight train too hard before a marathon or anything else, but I've just gone back to weight training my legs because I read somewhere that squats and like leg presses are good for the running, so I'm doing them. But I know if I do that a little bit before a marathon or an ultra, it's going to hurt the run.
For sure, yeah. I mean, I do the weight training too, but it's not my favorite. It's probably my weakest part of all of this is doing the weight training. But I try to get those in during the week as well. I'm not really a weightlifter, so I'm not really into that, but I know it's important, you know, overall for your run health, I guess, to keep your body, you know, able to manage those miles.
You know, there's actually, I think I've been talking to people about it. I think the problem I'm having right now is the weight of the muscle when I run now, because when I was during COVID, I got super skinny and I ran faster and I ran more miles, but now that I've become a little muscular, I mean, I've basically, you know, gotten muscles. I'm a little heavier when I run now, and it does have an effect.
That's interesting. Yeah, I did the opposite. I put on a lot of fat during COVID, and so I lost a lot of weight when I started running. So I'm really not looking forward to putting on any muscle weight because I'm at a really good weight right now for my running. But you know, you got to keep those legs strong. And that your core, you know, get prized to much your core gets worked.
Oh yeah, no, I'm trying to build up my stomach just for my core, because I mean, the funny thing about how I work out is like everything about me is tight except my stomach. And I look ripped, but then there's like when you look at my stomach, there's like a little bit of looseness there because I haven't worked my stomach enough. Kind
I find my stomach before, you know, after about 10 miles, your core starts to really get sore. That was surprising to me because you're just running, you know, and then to have your core get really sore after that is that was kind of an awakening.
You learn a lot when you run. I mean, it's like, I don't know how you are, but I mean, because I've run sometimes 2 to 3 hours a day, and for me, it's kind of meditative, you know, meditative. It kind of goes zen out, and I just, you know, drift when I'm running. Sometimes I don't even listen to music.
Yeah, I do the same thing. I mean, that's the part that I really like. It's like trying to find that perfect run where your mind is kind of out there and you're just, your body doesn't feel any pain and you're hitting a good pace. You know, that's what I look for a lot of times, trying to get that perfect run in.
Yeah, the funny thing about the Bulldog Ultra, it was painful, but at the same time, the scenery was great. You know, it was up the elevation, the clouds and all that, and nature. And I think I'd rather run trail runs than run. Like, I mean, I'm going to do the LA Marathon and other marathons, but I prefer doing trail running.
You know, I've started doing some trail running. I mean, not that many miles, just training in the trails. And it is really, it's really comforting. You know, you're in the shade a lot of times up here in the Puget Sound, and there's lots of trees and animals, and it is really nice. You know, it's a whole different kind of vibe.
I mean, most of the half marathons I'm doing now are all trails, and I'm kind of probably going to start, like, I'm not going to do half marathons that don't have trails anymore, because it's just, you know, I might as well enjoy the 13 miles, because it's not a marathon.
Yeah, those are definitely something I'm gonna have to try, because you know, just running on the pavement, it does get kind of bland at times. But I do like the competition when there's lots of people, you know, around and you can pass them or whatnot, try to keep up with them. Imagine trail running would be similar, but I'm not sure about. I mean, are there lots of people on trail runs as well?
Oh yeah, but it thins out pretty quick. Because what I've noticed about when I do trail runs, the half marathons, a lot of people don't train for hills.
Yeah.
And I run a lot of hills, so, you know, when people are walking up the hills, I'm running up the hills, and I get a little bit of distance between me and them, and some people are more trained to be, and they're ahead of me, so I always end up by myself a little bit.
Yeah, I know that. I know that feeling. There's a lot of hills that I run. I live on an island, and it's just full of hills, and they're quite the struggle to train on them, you know. In fact, I don't run on flat very often at all due to the fact that this island is all hilly. But, I guess trail run, and then you have like roots and a lot of rocks and things you have to look for too, probably.
But yeah, the funny thing about trail running to me, I have tripped and fallen more times running in the city than I do when I do trail runs.
That's counterintuitive. You'd think you would do the opposite.
Well, no, the thing is, I'm more aware of everything in the trail, but, you know, in the city, erosion will build up a sidewalk, and, you know, if you're running fast enough and you clip, you'll fly a little bit of distance before you hit the ground.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and that's what always happens when I'm not, you know, like, nobody maintains the city that well. I mean, where I live, I mean, you would think that being Los Angeles and shit in Hollywood, they would be more maintained, but it's not. So every once in a while, like, clip and go flying.
Do you take a hydration pack with you when you're on your trail runs, or?
Well, actually, because of the Ultra, I just got a hydration pack, and I'm probably going to start using it more when I do trail runs. But I was kind of an idiot because I did about 4 marathons with no liquid.
That's how I feel. Like, I'm not really keen on carrying a bunch of liquid, but I guess when you're running a marathon, you might need to hydrate somewhere along the line.
The good thing about the marathon, they have stations that have, you know, water, electrolytes, and sometimes they pass out gels. But if you have a gel that you prefer, because the problem with gels is if you take the wrong gel and it fucks up your stomach, it's going to fuck up your run. So I actually, you know, I've tried the gel that I took on the Ultra run before I did the run to make sure it wasn't going to upset my stomach during the Ultra.
I do the same. I'm experimenting with different gels, but I still can't get quite used to carrying water. Just the way it sloshes around, and I guess maybe a pack would be a little better if you can keep the
Hydro packs are great because you got that little straw, and it's off to the side, so it's not in the way. And the one thing I did learn, do not wear a hydro pack without a T-shirt. It'll scratch up your back.
That's a good tip. Do you have like a 2-liter? Is that about the size that you carry?
Yep, I got a 2 liter. I got a 2 liter for the Ultra. And the funny thing is, I ended up filling up that thing 3 times.
Wow. So do you need a... you probably need a pit crew or something to go with you on those, right?
Well, the 31 mile not, but I was told for the 50 mile run that I want to do in January, I'm going to need people there to help me, you know, maybe get some food or have, you know, some stations. I know during the 100 mile run that Sabrina just did, she had a pit crew and she had a pacer. And it was all set up, you know, and...
Yeah, you got to have
you got to have support group, you know, when you're running that many miles.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I heard about the marathon, that they have the pacers, and I don't know if they have a certain jersey on or something. How do you find your pacer? I mean,
they got pacers. They carry little signs too that stick up saying that they're pacers and the speed they're going and stuff like that. I actually interviewed a pacer last week. That's what she does at Delhi Marathon. She's one of the pacers.
Okay, so I did a 10K a couple of weeks ago, and they had a lady with a sign, and I guess she would have been the pacer. I guess that's how they do it, with a sign like that.
Yep, so you know who it is.
Okay, all right. Yeah, it's going to be exciting. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm trying to try to stay around the three-hour mark, but that's being really optimistic.
Well, you know, 3 hours is good. I'm hitting it in 4 hours, and I mean, my best time since I've gotten back into it has been 4 hours and 9 minutes.
Well, I'm just aiming for 3 hours. Realistically, I might be a little under 4 hours. If I finish it all, I don't know. That's my goal. I don't sure how I'm going to do because I've never ran one.
I never worry about finishing. I just try to enjoy the run, hoping I finish. But, you know, the thing is, if I just enjoy it, I end up finishing. You know,
that's a good point, yeah.
The thing is, some people I've seen in marathons, they sprint right away and then they end up killing themselves. The thing is, I don't try to over sprint. I mean, I do pick up speed, but then I slow down, pick up speed, slow down. But you got to find a pace that's working and keep that pace, because if you overexert yourself, you're going to end up killing yourself before you finish.
No doubt. I've seen that even with like 10Ks, people, you know, flat out sprint and then they just can't finish, you know, or they have to walk at the end. But I know a marathon is going to be a whole different animal. You really got to keep that pace in mind.
you feel the pace and you know, you can tell how fast you're going. And, you know, I mean, I got a watch. So it tells me, you know, and my watch is obnoxious. It tells me how fast I'm going each mile.
You must have a Garmin.
No, I actually got a Samsung. I want a Garmin because I heard Garmins are better than Samsung. More active.
Well, I just got my Garmin. I just got one the other day, and it definitely does the same thing. It tells me the pace and, you know, every mile, what kind of pace you're hitting. But, yeah, that's they're handy little tools to have.
Well, no, I mean, I look at everything. I mean, right now I'm going to probably get some aftershocks for running for music because they last 8 hours. I don't always need the music, but, you know.
But those are the ones that go on your skull, right?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. They're supposed to be really good. I haven't tried them yet, but the Beats I just had just died on me, which wasn't fun, you know, before
the
marathon.
Well, if you're doing ultras.
You were saying?
If you're doing ultras, you know, you need something with probably a long battery life as well as your watch. You know, those things would probably have to last for quite a while.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, you know, the thing, the beautiful thing about the trailer, and I forgot that I didn't have music, you know, because it was a good experience. I mean, as I get more into the running community, I noticed how supportive some runners are, you know, and how, like, if you look like you're in deep shit, they'll stop and help you and make sure you're okay.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I agree with that. There's a nice community of people.
I mean, I know the whole thing about running to me is, like, every time I run in the city and I see another runner, you know, we just, you know, we high five, whatever, we know that what we're doing, you know, that, you know, it's something. And I don't think people who aren't runners realize how much energy and how much it takes to keep doing this every day, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Do you ever have to, like, catch up to them or try to pass them?
Not always. I mean, I have a couple times.
I find that if I see a runner, I want to try to pass them, you know, or catch up.
No. I mean, that's good and competitive, but I know, you know, I mean, I've done that a couple. Like, okay, I passed them. Now what?
Yeah.
You know,
right.
It's fun, you know. I mean, I went and saw this old guy, and you know, he was out distancing me, and then when he finally stopped and took her down, I go, "Look, man, I was following you, and you were giving me a good chase." He goes, "What do you mean?" I go, "I was trying to catch up to you. The only reason I catch up to you is because you had stopped. And I don't want to ask, but how old are you?" He goes, 75. I go, "You're fucking 75 and you're outdistancing me. I feel fucking bad now." He goes, "Why?" "Because you're outrunning me at your age."
And well, let's hope we can run when we're 75.
No, the thing is, you know, I made the dude feel good, but no, he was outrunning me, and I just kind of like, fuck, can't even keep up with him.
There's some nice runners out there that are even older, you know, they really got it going on.
But no, I mean, it's the thing is, if I see somebody who's that, you know, that well taken care of, I mean, and they're passing me, I'll tell them, you're doing great, you know, because, you know, you don't know how far between people get compliments, you know, how, you know, somebody gets encouraged or how they don't get encouraged.
Most definitely, you know? Yeah. I agree with that for sure, yeah.
You know, And so I don't know if you run with people, but I tend to run by myself. So it's kind of like, you know, I don't know why I don't run with a group, but I like being able to make my own, you know, schedule without having to like wait for a bunch of other people to show up and then run.
Yeah. I've tried to run with other people, but I can't find anyone to run with. So I guess I've just been used to running by myself and just kind of, you know, not having to, it's just the way it's been for me, you know? So, I kind of like running by myself now. It's just, like you said, you can set your own schedule. You can go at your own pace.
Yep.
You don't have to, you know, you don't have to wait or worry about anything. You just get in the zone and off you go.
Yep. So what do you do for nutrition? Because I tend to eat all the wrong things, but I mean, because I run so much, I don't gain that much weight, but I still eat all the wrong things.
Yeah, you know, I'm not the best. I mean, I try to eat a lot of salads and you know, try to maintain my carbs and lean proteins. But sometimes, you know, I got to hit the fast food places every now and again. You know, after running like 15 miles, you know, you can burn through, you know, thousands of calories. And so it's hard to replenish that. And so, you know, I'll eat a whole medium pizza, you know, if I'm being real guilty that day. But, I don't know. I try to eat well, but sometimes, like you said, time doesn't permit or whatever. So you just end up eating whatever you can get your hands on.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, today I'm probably going to have a double cheeseburger and a chili cheese fries and a Perrier. See, I'm avoiding the soda. That's the only good part of this is I'm avoiding the soda.
You know, I got to say, I don't drink soda either. I just drink a lot of water or electrolyte water, you know, things like that. But I don't drink sodas hardly at all. You know, that's true. I didn't really, like, consciously avoid soda. It's just something that has happened. I don't really crave it or anything. So I guess that's a bonus.
The thing is, when I started working out, I started noticing the sugar more. You know, how it's just basically sugar water.
Right. Yeah. And you know, the thing with me being, you know, 50 is that I have to really stay hydrated. So, I really got to focus on, that's probably the hardest thing is I got to get my 2 liters in a day or I'll feel it when I run, I'll feel my legs or my back or something will start to bother me. So if I keep the hydration levels really high, it seems like things go smoother. And I think soda in some ways dehydrates me.
Yep. Yep. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, so I just eat, you know, I try to eat healthy, but mostly just drink a lot of water and try to stay on the healthy path. But every now and again, you know, you got to have the pizzas, pastas, and hamburgers, you know.
At work, I have a gallon jug of water that I fill up with ice, and I just keep – I refill it and refill it and refill it till I finish work.
Yeah, that's how you keep your –
It's just I mean, I need to stay hydrated. I know that, you know. And
yeah,
I gotta
replenish
all the water.
Yeah, and then you're going to the bathroom all the time, which kind of is a bummer. But, you know, if you want to run some good miles, I guess, you got to keep that hydration going.
Like my boss goes to me, why do you run so much? Why do you go to the bathroom so much? I go, dude, you've seen me running. So what do you think I do all day at work? I drink water. If you drink as much water as I do, you're going to go a lot. And it's just, I mean, I don't, I mean, I, my work's not suffering. I just go to the bathroom a lot. But,
and that's a definite...
You know,
that's the side effect right there of a runner, I guess.
No, I mean, another thing I didn't know, but because I thought it was not normal that I was doing it, I was carrying toilet paper in my pocket when I was running just in case. Then I read somewhere that that's normal for runners. You know?
Yeah, you know,
I haven't had...
I've read about that, too. I haven't had to do it yet, but I can totally relate because sometimes you're out there and you know, I guess moving your core around so much, it makes things start to move around.
Yep. No, I mean, I've gotten lucky when I've had the toilet paper, when I see a porta potty, but the thing is, porta potties aren't always stocked.
True.
They're there. Paper. But, you know, I mean, it's like... It's all these things that you don't think about that, you know, you might need. I mean, I've got rain gear because I don't mind running in the rain, but I don't want to get totally soaked. You know, I mean, all these things that I've learned that I can do. I mean, I actually ran for 7 miles in the rain when it was pouring, but after I got to the gym, took a shower, was fine. I was more annoyed when I was sitting waiting for the bus in the rain than running in the rain.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think that once you're running, like, I don't know, the mindset just turns on and, you know, you just got to be in that unstoppable kind of mind frame, you know. So whether it's windy or raining or snowing, you know, just got to keep, I don't know, I just try to keep focused on my run.
I mean, that's all you can do. I mean, it's like, I don't know, I mean, I've missed a couple of days, and I'm probably not going to miss any more days because I'm actually, right now my mindset is 50 miles in January, so I'm training for that, and that's all I'm thinking about is trying to, like, you know, build up the endurance,
that's a lot of miles. Yeah.
But I think
so you're running,
31 miles. But go ahead.
Are you running just long and slow to get that endurance built up?
Yep. But I also do the speed runs every other day, which I think the speed runs don't have a little strength. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say on your speed runs, is that like, are you doing like fartleks or you do like, what does your speed runs entail?
Just running straight 5 miles without stopping.
And is that, this
which
is like that, a high heart rate pace?
I can barely breathe sometimes. I mean, it's hard to catch a breath. I've noticed.
Okay, yeah, I kind of do something similar, but I try to run, you know, like maybe a mile at full speed, and then the next mile I go at a recovery speed, and then I run another mile at a full speed, and then I recover and kind of pulse that through a couple of miles.
Well, the funny thing about running the 5 miles in the city, I have to follow the direction of the lights and the stop signs, you know?
Oh, yeah,
because
that's true,
I don't have a visual map made in my head anymore because I've given up because the lights aren't always going to go my way, so I have to go wherever the lights tell me to go. So, I mean, I try
to
run.
I guess that could be annoying.
No, but you get used to it. I mean, sometimes I'm probably going to start running by the beach down in, you know, Pacific Coast Highway because I could run straight through without lights and I do a speed run. I mean, to me, a long-distance run, I don't mind running in place, but when I'm doing a speed run, I'm actually trying to get a good time.
That's interesting. I never considered that because where I'm at, I don't have to worry about lights at all. I can run 15 miles without a light even in my way. So I haven't really considered street light problems.
I would kill for something like that in my world, you know?
The only problem I have is there's lots of hills. Yeah.
See, I mean, when that happens to me is when I run up to Lake to the Hollywood sign, I go uphill, then I come out, then I run down Forest Lawn, and that's a good like 10 miles where there's nobody and there's nothing. But those aren't easy. Those aren't easy miles, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
Because it's all uphill. But I don't mind it. But at the same time, that's the, you know, the what I that's the only time I can actually, you know, be by myself, because most all over the city, there's scooters, there's bicycles, there's cars that aren't looking where they're going. They're not paying attention to the runner. They don't care. You know, I mean.
Yeah, they got to be. That would definitely make for a different kind of different style of running. You'd really have to be on alert, and
it does. You know, you learn to pay attention.
So when the light is red, do you just turn, make a right turn, or do you just wait for the light?
Yep. Don't wait for the light. I got to keep going because I don't want my time to suck.
That's what I was thinking. You'd probably have to turn and then,
I mean, if there's no cars coming, I'll run the light, but that's just bad. What'd you get a ticket for? Jaywalking.
Yeah, I can see
like,
that.
What were you doing? I was running. Oh no! One time in Hollywood at 4 a.m, I ran a red light and a cop stopped me and he got mad at me because I wouldn't stop running in place. He goes, "What's your hurry?" I go, "It's 4 a.m. There's no cars. Did you really have to stop me?" And the cop actually told me, "Well, I had nothing better to do." I'm like, "So you stopped me because you have nothing better to do?" That's fucked up.
That is. That's. You think that they wouldn't care, you know, but.
No, he just told me straight out, "You just didn't have nothing better to do, and you want to know what my hurry was." And I go, "Well, I'm running. I didn't feel like waiting for a light when there's no cars. I didn't think it was a bad thing because there's no cars."
Maybe next time they try to pull you over, just keep running and see how many police it takes pull over the runner.
You'd be surprised how crazy LA cops are. You'd be surprised. He was resisting arrest. That's why we tased him. What was he doing?
That would be fair.
He was running away from us. Why was he running? Well, he was running in the first place. Did you not notice that, you know, that he had, like, you know, running shorts and shit like that? Was that kind of, like, tell you what he's doing? You know, did he have anything he stole? No, he was just running. It's like, oh, crap. You know, but.
Yeah, that's insane. I mean, I couldn't imagine. I get to run basically any direction, you know, without traffic lights or anything like that. And so it's nice.
It seems that. I mean, I'd probably like to live around there because, I mean, I like, I don't like running the city because I have to tune it all out, but it's still there. You know, I mean, I don't like seeing the homeless people. I don't like knowing that they're there because, you know what, there's nothing I can do about it. And I kind of hate not being able to do anything about it because just because I ignore it doesn't mean it's not there, you know?
Sure. Yeah, I get it. Yep. I know Seattle's pretty bad. I've ran over there a few times, but, you know, there's still places in Seattle you can run quite a distance without any lights or anything, but there will be a lot of people and a lot of, you know, like tent encampments. And so I just find that increases my pace. You know, I try to just run a little faster through there, you know, but, that's reality. Nothing I can do about it. You know, I feel bad, but,
the fascinating thing about a homeless field, one time I tripped and fell, and the only person who tried to help me up was a homeless person. There's a bunch of other people who weren't homeless, but he tried to help me. I mean, I got up. I didn't need help, but I thanked him. And another time, a homeless person actually running gave me a bottle of water, and I gave him $2 and told him to keep his water. You know, I gave him the $2 because this guy's homeless, and he's giving me his bottle of water.
Sure,
you know,
You
know, and that meant a lot. And a lot of people won't give you shit, and they got, you know, and it's kind of amazing when somebody who has nothing is willing to give you their water, you know?
Yep.
That's a lot of, you wouldn't notice stuff like that. I wouldn't have noticed stuff like that if I didn't run, that, you know, certain things that I wouldn't have seen of human nature if I hadn't been running, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Which, I mean, you know.
That's kind of a blessing in some ways, you know, learning more about people as you run.
So
when's
the
run Winchester Marathon coming up?
It's in November, I think the 26th.
Well, I think we should have you probably back maybe in December, so you could tell us about how you did in the marathon. I mean,
well, then that puts a lot of pressure on me to do well or to at least finish.
Well, you know, you're either going to have a good story to tell in December, or you're going to tell us about what happened. But you can't think about that. You just got to think, I'm going to get it done, and I'm going to have a good story.
Oh, I'll definitely get it done. I mean, I have no doubt that I won't finish, and I'm pretty optimistic about it. I just sometimes I run, you know, the 17 miles and think, wow, I still have basically 10 more to do, you know, and I've only got a few more months to try to get that 10 extra miles. So,
oh yeah. The one thing I learned recently when I did the ultra is I had no idea I could go that long and not stop. I just learned more because I was just trying to get it done. I didn't know how long it was going to take me to get done. I didn't care the time I did because at least I did it. But the thing is, the mind is the most powerful thing you can have when you're running. You have to believe that, you know, you can get there. You know?
That's true. Yeah. I think that's your mind is the ultimate, like when you're running. I mean, your body can want to give up, but your mind, you know, just keep pushing. And then finally your body will just quit complaining, you know?
Yep. Nope. I mean, I ran with toenails hanging out and about to fall off. I ran in with blisters. I've done all types of work. I ran the Orange County Marathon with a cut up foot, you know?
And you just. Yeah, you just block that pain out and just keep focused. You know, as long as you're not injured to the point where you can't run, you can always seem to overcome it, you know. And I think that also carries over.
No, I agree with you. I mean, it does carry over into a lot of things.
Yeah, because, you know, in life you get stressed out or you have, you know, issues. And then, you know, if you can run so many miles and be strong through that, then – you know, life gets easier, I think, in a lot of ways.
You figure when I could do that, I should be able to survive this, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
It's been great having you on the show, and I definitely want to book you probably for sometime in December, like maybe a week after your marathon.
Oh, that would be great. I appreciate it.
No, I mean, the thing is with the show is that I've told runners, I want to have you on again, so then, you know, people who've listened to the show, like, remember the runner and see the progress. And then, you know, it either, you know, people learn, you know, they can keep going. And, you know, there are examples, you know. People have examples of, like, you know, persistence and stuff.
Yeah, that would be great. I wouldn't mind at all. Definitely would look forward to it.
Well, it's been great having you on the show again. I just had Michael Abram on the show. And it's been a great show, and wish him well for his first marathon, because I remember my first marathon, and it was pretty damn scary the first time you did it. I mean, I was young. I mean, I was a lot younger. I mean, I'm actually 56, so I definitely know what it means to be our age at this time.
Well, thanks for having me,
I'll be sending you the link.
It.
Yeah, thanks a lot
right,
for coming on the show. Take care.
All right, thanks a lot.
This has been the Poet Runner Podcast. Thank you for listening.